Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 747, Bringing It All Back Home. This program is being recorded on June 26th of the year 2011. In Side 1, we spent most of our time covering an article that was authored by Robert Perry and posted on his Consortium News website. The article basically compares the CIA's destabilization of the Allende regime in Chile in the early 70s, and in turn it compares similar types of covert operations undertaken by the U.S. intelligence apparatus to the Republican playbook both for America and for the political destabilization of the Obama administration. Central to the destabilization of the Obama administration is the economic and social destabilization of the United States, rather like the way that Chile was deliberately destabilized in order to cast Allende out of power, except that in this circumstance, we're talking about the U.S., not Chile, and we're talking about the American economy, not the Chilean economy. I would note that one thing Robert Perry does not do is to note that there is already a pattern of applying covert action and the deadly force that sometimes accompanies that here in the United States, and that tradition is decades old. We concluded our discussion in Side 1 by taking a look at an article that we looked at in For the Record number 412 from 8 years ago, The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train. Paul Krugman, in turn citing information presented in the Financial Times, has noted that the Bush administration was deliberately promoting a future fiscal crisis by running up enormous deficits that would force the cutting of valued social programs in order to preserve Americans and the world from the consequences of the very financial crisis that they were in the process of deliberately creating with their budgetary recklessness. One aspect of how they deliberately created this crisis was the deliberate suppression of a report that was created by the Treasury Department under Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, George Bush's Treasury Secretary, who was forced out of office in December of 2003. We're going to once again reprise an article that we looked at in For the Record 412. This is called Report Warns of Chronic U.S. Deficits. It's by Perronet de Pen. It's from the Financial Times of May 29th of 2003. It reads in part, "The Bush administration has shelved a report commissioned by the Treasury Department that shows that the U.S. currently," by the way, this is June of 2003, "that the U.S. currently faces a future of chronic federal budget deficits totaling at least $44.2 trillion in current U.S. dollars. The study, the most comprehensive assessment of how the U.S. government is at risk of being overwhelmed by the baby boom generation's future health care and retirement costs, was commissioned by then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. But the Bush administration chose to keep the findings out of the annual budget report for fiscal year 2004, published in February, as the White House campaigned for a tax cut package that critics claim will expand future deficits," unquote. The study asserts that sharp tax increases, massive spending cuts, or a painful mix of both are unavoidable if the U.S. is to meet benefit promises to future generations. It estimates that closing the gap would require the equivalent of an immediate and permanent 66% across-the-board income tax increase. This last sentence again, because this is a whopper. The study asserts that sharp tax increases, massive spending cuts, or a painful mix of both are unavoidable if the U.S. is to meet benefit promises to future generations. It estimates that closing the gap would require the equivalent of an immediate and permanent 66% across-the-board income tax increase. Mr. O'Neill, excuse me, I want to issue a correction. He was fired in December of 2002. This was 2003. He was already gone, but the report was basically that this came out in February of 2003. It was put together by O'Neill's department, but he was gone at this point. Continuing with this Financial Times article from May 29th of 2003, Mr. O'Neill, who was fired last December, refused to comment on the report. The study's analysis of future deficits dwarfs previous estimates of the financial challenge facing Washington. It is roughly equivalent to 10 times the publicly held national debt, 4 years of U.S. economic output, or more than 94% of all U.S. household assets. Alan Greenspan, Federal Reserve Chairman, last week bemoaned what he called Washington's, quote, deafening silence about the future crunch, unquote. The estimates reflect the extent to which the annual deficit, the national debt, and other widely reported backward-looking data are becoming archaic and misleading as measures of the government solvency. Mr. Kent Smetters, now a University of Pennsylvania finance professor, said tax cuts were only a fraction of the imbalance and that the bigger problem is the whole budget language we're using, unquote. Lawrence Kotlikoff, an expert on long-term budget accounting, alleged in a recent Boston Globe editorial that the Bush administration suppressed the research in order to deliberately ease passage of the tax cut plan. Well, the whole idea, basically, was behind that tax cut plan was to make things worse. And by the way, the situation as described there, that was a report that was released in February of 2003 and suppressed by the Bush administration after firing the person whose department, Paul O'Neill, of the Treasury Department, cranked that report out. It is a lot worse today. And remember that this has been done deliberately. Why? Well, let's take a look at an article from the New Republic. It is talking here about the white working class, the group that will likely decide Obama's fate. Well, and how are they going to be feeling about Obama after basically the situation that Robert Perry was describing has become manifest? Well, we'll see. This again by from the New Republic of June 20th of 2011, an article by Rui Teixeira. It's headlined again, "The White Working Class, the Group That Will Likely Decide Obama's Fate." Each election cycle, there occurs a tired ritual in which pundits and reporters rediscover that, yes, indeed, there are still a lot of white working class voters in America, and they represent a serious vulnerability for the Democrats. But just this once, let's skip the period where everyone initially ignores this group and cuts straight to the chase. There will be a lot of white working class voters showing up at the polls next November, and the degree to which they support or abandon President Obama could very well make or break his reelection. In 2008, during his otherwise solid election victory, Obama lost the white working class by 18 points. In 2010, however, things got much worse. Congressional Democrats experienced a catastrophic 30-point deficit drop among the same group, working-class white voters. While the first number is a figure Obama could live with repeating, the second could very well prove fatal. Indeed, if Republicans can replicate that 30-point deficit in 2012, a margin which seems increasingly possible given the recent bad news about the economy, Obama will have little or no room for error among his other constituencies. For example, even if, as expected, the share of minority voters increases from 26 to around 28% in the next election, and Obama receives the typical 75% of that vote, while his share of white working class voters declines by another 3 percentage points, a 30-point hole in Obama's white working class support would mean that the overall support he needs to win the election was teetering right on the knife's edge. In such a scenario, Obama would have to hold essentially all of his white college graduate support from 2008, 47%, the historic high for Democrats, to be assured of victory. And make no mistake about it, GOP strategy for 2012 will start with the white working class and attempt to drive up support among this group as high as possible. As an example, just take Mitt Romney's recently declared strategy. Quote, Romney advisors see a disconnect between the president's announcements of real progress on the economy at a time when there is, in the words of one, a massive disaster out there with people's lives, unquote. They argue that, on economic issues, Obama still has trouble connecting with voters, particularly those from the white working class. These tactics are likely to pay big dividends both nationally and, even more importantly, in the states where the election is actually decided. Consider the case of Ohio, a state the GOP must take back to take down Obama. White working class voters could end up representing as much as 56% of Ohio voters in 2012, judging from census voter supplement data. Anything close to a 30-point deficit in 2012 will almost definitely sink Obama in this state, no matter what happens with the friendlier portions of the Ohio electorate. Or take Florida, Nevada, and Colorado, other states that are vulnerable to a white working class collapse. Florida's 29 electoral votes would assure Obama's re-election, assuming he manages to carry the 18 states plus the District of Columbia that Democrats have carried in every presidential election since 1992, which, taken together, represent a total of 241 electoral votes. Compared to Ohio, Florida's white working class is smaller, a projected 42% of voters in 2012, but a 30-point deficit would still torpedo Obama's chances, putting this must-win state for the GOP firmly in their column. Nevada, 42% white working class in 2012, and Colorado, 46%, meanwhile, would also be put in serious doubt should Obama's support among this group crater in 2012. Even more alarmingly, the white working class vote provides the perfect way for the GOP to drive a wedge into those 241 electoral votes Democrats have held for five straight presidential elections. Contested states with high proportions of white working class voters like Minnesota, 60% white working class in 2012, Wisconsin 58%, Pennsylvania 55%, and Michigan 53%, could easily be flipped if this group flees from Obama. But how likely is such a white working class surge toward the GOP in 2012? From the standpoint of Obama and the Democrats, scarily so. It's important to remember that this is the group that has been the bulwark of every GOP victory going back to Richard Nixon in 1968, and it is the group recently termed by journalist Ronald Brown seen as, quote, the most pessimistic group in America, unquote. In a recent Pew Economic Mobility Project poll, only one-third of working-class whites thought today's children would live better than they do, far below the levels of confidence expressed by minorities and college-educated whites. And in a recent National Journal poll, only a third of white working-class voters took a positive view of recent census findings on the country's fast-growing minority population, with 58% endorsing instead the pessimistic view that these trends are, quote, happening too quickly, unquote, and undermining fundamental American values at a time of high unemployment. These views are obviously rooted in the bleak economic situation confronting most members of the white working class. While that's bad enough, what's worse is that the economy is showing no signs of the kind of progress that might take the edge off these sentiments. This should worry the Obama team greatly and encourage the so-called pivot, unquote, to the jobs issue that the administration is considering. A deal on debt reduction, however desirable for other reasons, will be no substitute for better economic conditions, especially among this difficult demographic. Note this last sentence. A deal on debt reduction, however desirable for other reasons, will be no substitute for better economic conditions, especially among this difficult demographic. To be sure, the good news for Obama is that the level of support he needs from this group of voters is not terribly high. While a 30-point deficit might sink him, he could survive pretty easily on a 23-point deficit, John Kerry's margin in 2004. That Obama would likely win with this very large deficit while Kerry lost indicates just how much the demographics of the country have changed in the 8 years since Kerry's defeat. But while the bar for Obama may be lower, he still needs to clear it, and at the moment, That's looking like a real challenge. And that, of course, a right-wing op-ed column. But I do think that it makes a fairly concise point about what exactly it is that Obama is up against. And, of course, this is precisely the group that the Republican right is seeking to inflame. And the Democrats, by the way, are not doing anything to, well, they're not doing much to salve their situation, so to speak. I would also note that the political debate is being shaped by the right wing and by what are known as the deficit hawks. And who is being forgotten about? Not just the white working class, but the American middle class is being forgotten about as well. So dovetail that conservative column from the New Republic with the following. This is an article from by the Toronto Globe and Mail from June 9th of 2011. It's by Christia Freeland. It's titled, U.S. Middle Class Becomes a Big Business Afterthought. This column reads, the big mystery in the United States today is why the job crisis is not at the center of the political and economic debate. After all, the numbers and the human tragedies they reflect could not be bleaker. Nearly 14 million Americans, 9.1% of the working population, are unemployed. That's just a couple of a million shy of the combined populations of Greece and Ireland, Europe's two problem children. Another 8.5 million Americans would like to work full-time but can only find part-time jobs. A further 2.2 million have been so discouraged by the grim labor market that they have given up looking for work altogether. It's hard to blame them. Those still actively looking for work have been unemployed for an average of 39.7 weeks. These are cruel numbers, and they depict an unemployment crisis that is deeper and more sustained than at any time since 1948, when U.S. records first started to be kept. Yet the debate in Washington is focused on deficit reduction rather than job creation. The news media are following the same playbook. A recent database analysis by the National Journal found that over the past 2 years, the leading U.S. newspapers had dramatically shifted their attention from unemployment to the deficit and are now publishing more than three times as many stories about the budget as about jobs. This, again, is one of the reasons why I went into the Greek tragedy last week. What's happening in Europe in terms of the debate is very much happening here in the U.S. as well. Continuing, there are some differences, but there are a lot of similarities. Politicians and pundits on the left have begun warning that this relative indifference to joblessness is worse than a crime. It's a mistake. In a blog posting, the former Labor Secretary Robert Reich said, quote, the economic burdens of America's vast middle class may be catching up with the street, unquote. Unless more jobs are created soon, he warned, American consumers will not have enough purchasing power to buy what the private sector can produce, unquote. The reality may be even more chilling. Perhaps U.S. business is learning to get by just fine, thank you, without middle-class consumers. While that may be good news for chief executives and shareholders, it could be the beginning of a new and socially wrenching political logic that leaves the great American middle class behind. Wall Street, which is paid for smarts, not sentiment, has this figured out. In a newspaper interview earlier this month, Robert Dole, chief equity strategist at BlackRock, the largest money manager in the world, pointed out that the fortunes of U.S. companies and the fortunes of the country as a whole are diverging. Quote, the U.S. stock market and the U.S. economy are increasingly different animals, unquote. Mr. Dole's explanation for the shift was the growing importance of international markets rather than the domestic one, of the rising middle class in emerging markets rather than the stagnating one back home. He said that over the next 5 years, 70% of the incremental earnings of the Standard & Poor's 500 companies would come from outside the United States. 20th century American capitalism was built on what you might call the Henry Ford model. Generously compensated workers to whom Ford paid double the existing rate created a mass middle class that bought the products of the country's entrepreneurs. That virtuous circle made the United States the world's economic behemoth and created a society and a political discourse defined by a proudly acquisitive middle class, the much-admired and much-maligned U.S. consumer culture. But for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, that link between keeping up with the Joneses and the rising value of the Dow Jones Industrial Average may be breaking. Unemployment remains stuck above 9%, but since March of 2009, when stocks hit their post-crisis bottom, the Dow has risen more than 85%. When the chief of General Motors, Charles Wilson, told a U.S. Senate confirmation hearing in 1953 that he believed that what was good for the country was good for GM and vice versa, he took some flack for uttering such a self-serving line. But we all remember it because Mr. Wilson captured something axiomatic about the connection between the fortunes of U.S. business and the welfare of the country as a whole. The creative destruction of 21st century capitalism seems to be requiring U.S. companies to learn to prosper with fewer U.S. workers and with fewer U.S. middle-class consumers. We do not know yet how U.S. democracy, where the middle class has the votes but the business class has the money, will respond to this tough new economic logic. Well, how will the U.S. democracy respond to this tough new economic logic? Well, I wish that I could say that I was optimistic, but I am not. I think by way of reflecting on what's coming, we might use yet another op-ed column. This was the very last op-ed column that was authored by Bob Herbert of the New York Times. He authored this on March 25th of 2011. It's called Losing Our Way. Oddly enough and appropriately enough, this column was authored on the, or printed, published on the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. That fire on March 25th of 1911 basically had much to do with forging the U.S. labor movement. And we're going to get into some interesting statistical analysis provided by Bob Herbert in this column. He called his last column for the New York Times from March 25th of 2011, Losing Our Way. It reads, "So here we are pouring shiploads of cash into yet another war, this time in Libya, while simultaneously demolishing school budgets, closing libraries, laying off teachers and police officers, and generally letting the bottom fall out of the quality of life here at home. Welcome to America in the second decade of the 21st century. An army of long-term unemployed workers is spread across the land, the human fallout from the Great Recession and long years of misguided economic policies. Optimism is in short supply. The few jobs now being created too often pay a pittance, not nearly enough to pry open the doors of a middle-class standard of living." Arthur Miller, echoing the poet Archibald MacLeish, liked to say that the essence of America was its promises. That was a long time ago. Limitless greed, unrestrained corporate power, and a ferocious addiction to foreign oil have led us to an era of perpetual war and economic decline. Young people today are staring at a future in which they will be less well off than their elders, a reversal of fortune that should send a shudder through everyone. The U.S. has not just misplaced its priorities. When the most powerful country ever to inhabit the earth finds it so easy to plunge into the horror of warfare, but almost impossible to find adequate work for its people or to properly educate its young, it has lost its way entirely. Nearly 14 million Americans are jobless, and the outlook for many of them is grim. Since there is just one job available for every five individuals looking for work, four of the five are out of luck. Instead of a land of opportunity, the U.S. is increasingly becoming a place of limited expectations. A college professor in Washington told me this week that graduates from his program were finding jobs, but that they were not making very much money, certainly not enough to think about raising a family. Bear in mind the article there, the op-ed column we just looked at from the Toronto Globe and Mail, about big business basically turning its back on the U.S. middle class. Continuing with the Bob Herbert column. "There is plenty of economic activity in the U.S. and plenty of wealth, but like greedy children, the folks at the top are seizing virtually all the marbles. Income and wealth inequality in the U.S. have reached stages that would make the third world blush." Now, note the statistics in the following study. As the Economic Policy Institute has reported, the richest 10% of Americans received an unconscionable 100%, i.e., all, of the average income growth in the years 2000 to 2007, the most recent extended period of economic expansion. In other words, the top 10% of Americans received all of the growth in income in 2000 to 2007. Continuing, Americans behave as if this was somehow normal or acceptable. It shouldn't be, and it didn't used to be. Through most of the post-World War II era, income distribution was far more equitable, with the top 10% of families accounting for just a third of average income growth, and the bottom 90% receiving two-thirds. That seems like ancient history now. The current maldistribution of wealth is also scandalous. In 2009, the richest 5% claimed 63.5% of the nation's wealth, or just under two-thirds of the nation's wealth. The overwhelming majority, the bottom 80% or the bottom four-fifths, collectively held just 12.8% or about an eighth of the country's wealth. This inequality, in which an enormous segment of the population struggles while the fortunate few ride the gravy train, is a world-class recipe for social unrest. Downward mobility is an ever-shortening fuse leading to profound consequences. That was Bob Herbert writing his last op-ed column for the New York Times on the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire. I think for not only analysis of what we're seeing, but a chilling forecast for how this is going to end up, was presented by James Stewart Martin when he wrote the book All Honorable Men. James Stewart Martin was the Justice Department official in charge with breaking up the corporate connections that precipitated World War II. He was unable to do so, and he noted the dangers of economic concentration. Writing in 1950, James Stewart Martin said, "The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. Should the United States run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity, then, may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, they could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who would do this are not Nazis, but businessmen, not criminals, but honorable men." That concludes Side 2 of For the Record, program number 747, Bringing It All Back Home. This has been recorded on June 26th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.